This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is journalist and best-selling author David Halberstam. He won a 1964 Pulitzer Prize for his reporting from Vietnam for the New York Times. Halberstam was one of the first American reporters to contradict the optimistic picture of the war which the American government was presenting to the public. He was attacked by South Vietnamese and American officials for negativism and inaccuracy. Madam New said Halberstam should be barbecued. President Kennedy suggested to the publisher of the Times that Halberstam was too close to the story and asked if they were considering transferring him to another bureau. David Halberstam retired from newspaper reporting in 1967 to write books and magazine articles. His books include The Best and the Brightest, about the roles of the Kennedy and Johnson administrations in the war, and The Powers That Be, a study of the growth of American mass media. Two of Halberstam's recent books have examined American values as expressed through sports. The Breaks of the Game looked at how big money and television are changing the game of basketball. His new book, Amateurs, is about rowing, a sport which is ignored by the media and remains untainted by commercialism. David Halberstam was once an athlete himself, but in college he had to choose between sports and journalism.
I played on the freshman basketball team. I had a full-time job, and I started working for the Harvard Crimson. At a certain point, it became very clear to me that I was being offered a career choice, and I dropped freshman basketball, which I sort of liked and actually was doing, I think, reasonably well at, and at that point became a journalist and spent about 50 or 60 hours a week on the Harvard Crimson. And that was, with a finality that I did not know at the time, was the ultimate career choice for me, because I never turned back. Not only did I turn my back on basketball, a little chance that I might have had as a career there, but I turned my back on law school, business school, PhD, anything else. I found something that I loved, and this was the first thing I'd ever been good at. You take an obsessive personality that, like mine, who's floundering in his social environment, and you finally give him or her something that allows him to be distinguished, and you have a match.
I think the myths surrounding what journalism was were different myths in the 1950s than they are now. What really attracted you to the idea of journalism? Were you involved in any of the romanticism?
I viewed it with a great deal of romanticism, and I still do. I still think it is. It's a more subtle kind of romanticism, but I think it's an awfully nice way to make a living. You can, I think, make a difference. You can be a part of the public sector. You can have a degree of social conscience, and you can be involved in events, and I think you stay young when you do that. I think you're, as I say, paid to learn. I'm sure there was a certain innocence and naivete to it, but there was a certain shrewdness that it was also what suited me, and it was the kind of life I wanted to lead. I did not want to be in a 9-to-5 job.
You got your start writing for papers in the South.
Yes, Mississippi.
Was that a conscious choice for you? Did you want to go to the South?
Yes, indeed. I graduated from college in 1955, and it was 1 year after Brown versus Board of Education, which is one of the great landmark events of our society, of our modern era, which is ending legal segregation. I mean, certainly there are a number of other decisions that come after that, but essentially ending the idea of separate but equal facilities. And I graduated a year later. I thought that even though I'd been managing editor of the Harvard Crimson and I'd worked on papers like the Hartford Current and the Boston Globe, I thought you ought to have an apprenticeship. And if you were going to apprentice, why not apprentice in the South, which would be something of a battleground? And I chose, and I was right, I was accurate. I mean, and therefore, in the 4 or 5 years that I spent in first Mississippi and then Tennessee, I had an extraordinarily rich apprenticeship. I mean, I did in 4 years or 5 years there what the average person starting out a comparable time might have taken 20 years in terms of experience being thrown in over your head. I mean, I remember writing stories that were about cities that were really out of control under racial crisis, and you had a sense of the validity of what you did. It wasn't just a hot career ticket.
You moved to New York eventually to join the New York Times.
I joined the Times, was hired by the Washington Bureau, didn't have a terribly good tour in Washington. This is some 24 and a half years ago. And then very quickly was sent to what was then the Congo, now Zaire, and then very quickly after that, really 23 years ago, to Vietnam.
You asked to be transferred. to Vietnam, and you wanted to go there at a time when very few Americans were paying any attention to Indochina.
And very few reporters wanted to go, 1962.
What did you foresee happening? What did you know?
I could tell that it was going to be an extraordinary story. I mean, I think reporters go where there are stories. I had just come out of the Congo. I'd spent 13 or 14 months there. It was a good story. It was an important story. There was a lot of action. Vietnam seemed to me to be rising up almost as an issue like the Spanish Civil War, that it was going to be this traumatic thing, that large forces were, unlike in the Congo, large forces were going to be engaged there. We had just made the Kennedy commitment of, I think, about 15,000 advisors. And for better or for worse, something was going to be played out there. I probably thought that we had a chance to win, and I was more hawkish than dovish when I first went. But whatever else, I knew that it was something that I wanted to cover. I was confident that I had, by then, the physical courage to do it. I was 27 years old, or 28, I guess, when I first got there, finally, 28. And I was single, so I wasn't like I had a family or estranged to hold back. I wanted to be a part of it, and I was very excited when I got the assignment and filled with enthusiasm.
Did you talk to any reporters who were or who had been in Vietnam before you got there, and did they give you any advice?
Sure. I was the first full-time correspondent covering the Vietnam. I have a small badge in history. I was the first reporter for a daily newspaper to be on permanent assignment in Vietnam, and I replaced one of the really legendary reporters of our in any age, Homer Biggert, who had won two Pulitzer Prizes, one in World War II, one in the Korean War, and who was a particular hero of mine anyway. And Homer had written me long cautionary letters about what to expect, who to trust, who not to trust, and letting me know that it was going to be a very, very hard assignment. I mean, that I was going to get belted around, he thought it probably was not going to work well, that the war was not going to be won, and therefore the reporter for the New York Times had better be prepared to be scapegoated and blamed if he wrote negatively.
So what were the rules of the game when you got there for a reporter?
Well, there really weren't any rules. You just go out and cover the war. I mean, the embassy and the American mission, MACV, tried to convince you that it was working. Someone once said that the only two exports of Vietnam were rice and American optimism, and they worked very hard to convince the reporters that, you know, that the war was being won. But almost every level, the more you went out in the field, the more clear it was that it wasn't.
Well, it seems to me that American and South Vietnamese government let you know that you should be thinking about being a team player.
Get on the team. Get on the team. That's what they used to say. The American ambassador to Vietnam, Mr. Nolting, once turned to me, and I had come back from a particularly grim tour of the Mekong Delta, where all my sources told me that we were losing the war. And I mentioned this in passing to him once. He just got furious at me, almost physically threw me out of his office and said, "You're always looking for the hole in the donut. You're always looking for the hole in the donut." The great pressure, what they were trying to do was make us be patriots. I have a rather broad gauge view of patriotism and the high levels of freedom in a society like ours. I don't think I need automatically to do what some general tells me to do. I mean, I don't need to accept his definition of patriotism. I have a lot of confidence in my own patriotism and my own intelligence. But it was very tough there. There were attacks upon our sexuality, our patriotism, our political. We were called communists. I mean, it was very nasty, and it was quite orchestrated out of the White House and the Defense Department.
Attacks on your sexuality? Am I to assume that people would call you homosexual if
you
didn't support the war?
Sissies, yeah. I mean, there was one, I remember one time, there was a general named Brute Krulak who gave a briefing, and one of my bete noirs was a woman reporter, right-wing woman reporter named Marguerite Higgins, and he went around saying that she had showed me pictures of Viet Cong bodies and I had burst into tears. It wasn't true, and I later confronted him. I mean, the story should have been true. I mean, I should have probably broken into tears, but I mean, it was that kind of thing of trying to undermine the credibility, the legitimacy that we didn't have in those days, some more than 20 years ago. We didn't have the word, the machismo, but I mean, that was really an attempt to say that this guy is a sissy and he really can't, he can't stand the sight of blood.
Was there a reward and punishment system that was used for reporters who played the game or didn't?
Well, that was the interesting thing. They tried to, and they just didn't have any rewards to hand out. I mean, they didn't have anything to punish with. I mean, it wasn't like, that was the early days of the Kennedy administration. The Kennedys were very good at rewarding reporters. If you were, I suppose, good and talented, you got to be invited to Hickory Hill or to the White House, or that you were favored, or at the press conference, perhaps the president called you by your first name, or Pierre Salinger would have lunch with you. I mean, the magnetic pull of the Kennedy social swirl was rather powerful then. We were 12,000 miles away. We could care bleep all about whether Jack or Jackie had us for dinner. We could care less whether we were invited to the embassy for dinner or by the general for dinner. I mean, they were a distant world. Our friends were the young Americans who were out in the as advisors in the war and in the Vietnamese as well. They were risking their lives. Every time we went out, we risked our lives, and that was quite often. And the last thing in the world we were going to do is, having risked our lives to cover a story, I was not going to cover up. I mean, having taken one risk, I wasn't going to play it cool. So they had no reward system. There was no social world that we wanted to be a part of. And the people that I respected, the people whose good wishes I wanted, were the people out, the advisors in the field. I wanted their respect. I mean, they were my sources. I didn't want them to tell me one thing and then look in the Times and see a rather watered-down story. I mean, that meant something to me. So the kind of control, social control, that a government has just didn't work on us at all. They tried it, and they tried to, you know, they played rough. If we did pessimistic stories, they would try and find our sources and punish them, and that, of course, just made us work harder.
What about the pressure, though, on those aides and advisors who were your sources? I'm surprised that there wasn't more pressure on them from the State Department.
There was a lot from the Defense Department. There was a lot, but they were, I think most of them were the kind of men who were responding to events, and I think they had young men on their staffs who were getting killed, and I think you can be theoretical about a war when you're in headquarters. You can sit there and be cynical about it. I think when you're in the field and you have young men who have died and you're writing letters to their widows, I don't think you're going to lie to a reporter whom you've come to know and trust. So I think that they were willing to risk their careers in many ways. I had a great source there named John Vann, who was a colonel and in the 7th Division advising the Arvin 7th Division there. And I remember when he finally pulled him back and I went to the airport to put him on the plane back to America. A whole bunch of us who were reporters gave him a little silver cigarette tray with his name. It said John Paul Vann, good soldier, good friend, and we all signed it. I think there's 5 or 6 Pulitzer Prize winners on that signature. And I remember talking to John, and I said I was nervous that my reporting was going to hurt you. And he gave me a very flinty look, and he said, "You never hurt me anymore that I wanted to be hurt." So they knew what they were doing.
My guest is David Halberstam, who won a Pulitzer Prize in 1964 for his reporting from Vietnam. He's written many books since that time. His latest is called The Amateurs, and it's about the sport of sculling. There were a few reporters who were expelled from Vietnam, I think by Madame Nu, because she was dissatisfied.
Well, I was right on the list. They once threw out a guy named Jim Robinson, who was NBC, and Francois Sully was expelled for about a year. I mean, the only real thing you had to worry about was expulsion. At the time that government fell, they had me down, instead of a year's visa, they had me down to a one-month-at-a-time visa. I mean, I was on a very thin thread, and that was certainly one thing I did not want to happen, which was to be expelled. Well, but you cannot write for your visa. You can never write for your visa.
Well, Madame New had said about you, Halberstam should be barbecued, and I would be glad to supply the fluid and the match. Did you ever go through periods of self-censorship, saying, is this story worth getting thrown out?
I think every reporter always in a situation when you're dealing with an authoritarian government that is monitoring you. I don't think self-censorship is the phrase, but you are always, you're aware of the amount of powder that you have and how much to use on a given story. I mean, if a big story comes in, you go with it, but you don't, I think, quickly, you don't lightly and gratuitously force an issue. I mean, I think every reporter is always in a situation like that, whether he's in the Soviet Union or whatever. He's aware that, you know, that he's balancing the need to be candid and inform his readers with the need to be able to survive as a reporter, and that takes a certain suppleness. But never self-censorship there. That was too important. If it had come to self-censorship, I'd have just you know, pulled the plug and gone because it was too much. Too much was at stake.
What were some of the stories that you wrote that most upset or irked American and Vietnamese officials?
Oh, it was not any one story. It was, although there was a couple stories I had that about the decline, the military decline in the Mekong Delta that really drove them crazy. It was a cumulative thing. With Kennedy, with President Kennedy, for instance, it was that my reporting day in and day out on the front page of the New York Times reflected a first-class foreign policy failure. I mean, he was enraged by it. By the end of his life, in the last couple months of his life, the whole thing was unraveling, and my colleague and I, Neil Sheehan, had just such good sources that we had that country wired. And he was just, I mean, he used to complain. I mean, he was complaining about me, and then he would also complain to Arthur Schlesinger Jr. that he could find out more in my stories than he could from reading the State Department cables and from the military cables. And then there were a series of stories on the Mekong Delta, on the military decline there, that they just went crazy about. Kennedy really, I think, believed them, and he sent the military off to sort of come up with their view, and they sent a, I think he's now Deputy Secretary of Defense. He was then a hot young brigadier general named Dick Stilwell out to sort of word by word challenge my stories. And I mean, he's a real handler on that one. In his version, the war was being won. He challenged every single word in my stories. And unfortunately, as the Pentagon Papers later made clear in one of their reports, my version was a good deal more accurate than his. But it was the kind of politics. I mean, I was running up against the politics of the American Defense Department.
Kennedy called your editor at the Times and suggested, you know, maybe they were thinking about transferring you. Maybe you'd gotten too close to the story.
Yeah. Well, that happens whenever you are giving people. I mean, Kennedy was never worried about anybody being too close to the story if he was getting his version.
What was the Times' reaction to that Kennedy request?
Oh, they were very good. I was supposed to come on home leave about then. They asked me to delay it for a couple of months, so they didn't want to look like they were acquiescing. They were quite good in general. I mean, they were made nervous by it. I don't think any. I mean, it's a very different circumstance. Those 25 years ago, everybody still had a World War II mentality. The idea that our generals might either be liars or fools was hard for, you know, patriotic men of that generation to understand. Here was their young reporter who was making the entire network of the embassy angry. And, you know, these were men that they had known, Maxwell Taylor and others they'd known in World War II, who were good and worthy men. And what was going wrong? So they were nervous by it, but they stood by me pretty well.
There were many editors back at the States who didn't stand by the reporters that well. And I think it was at Time magazine that a couple of stories were completely rewritten to make the story more.
It was Time's Disneyland. I mean, Time was very jingoistic in those days, and it was very hawkish. I mean, Time really, almost more than the military, wanted the war in those days. And the managing editor, I mean, Henry Luce had a sort of view of American imperialism in Asia, and the fact that American values would work, and the man who was in charge of making that vision true was the managing editor of the magazine, Otto Firbinger, and he was very tough, and he decided the first thing he would do to sort of turn things around was use the Time press section to assault those unworthy reporters who were being so pessimistic and whose patriotism was so sorely lacking.
I wonder if you think that foreign reporting is carried out in a much different fashion now than it was when you were abroad. If there's any more or less manipulation from the governments that are involved in the story, if the editors back in the States at the home publication are any more or less supportive of their reporters in the field.
Oh, I think that the Battle of Vietnam has been a battle that has immunized people pretty well. I think that when your reporters in the field say something, editors are now more inclined to listen. I think that that's one thing. I think the major change is one that we have fewer newspapers. You have monopoly papers, which is a different thing, monopoly, semi-monopoly situations. And I think the rise of television is the critical new ingredient. When I was in the early 60s in Vietnam, television was a really rather peripheral thing. Now it is, in many ways, a television game. Television is the dominant part of much of American foreign reporting, and it is, in some ways, it's rather more mindless than it used to be. Now it is about film, and film is action, so you get much more film. I mean, television loves the Iranian story. Television loves a hostage terrorist story. Television likes the Falklands for a week, maybe 2 weeks. Don't get too much of it, might get bored. And I think that's one way. So the foreign correspondents these days tend to be firemen. They are very good at, I mean, they're brave. God, they're brave. I mean, imagine covering Beirut for a network these days. I mean, heroic. But they tend not to be, with a few exceptions, particularly well-versed in their regions. They know the plane schedules in and out. They go wherever there's action. It's about combat and about violence. There are a few, John Cochran, a few other people are exceptions. Peter Jennings, when he was overseas, who brings some real knowledge and context. But it's, by and large, it's an action story. They're firemen.
Why did you give up foreign reporting?
Well, it wasn't so much giving up foreign reporting. I had been a daily. What I gave up was being a reporter for a daily newspaper. I'm still a reporter. I go out and read. The book on rowing is based upon reporting. It's saturation reporting, which is what I like doing. I left daily reporting after I'd done it for 12 years. If you count the years I spent doing it in college, it's closer to 15 years. And someone says, at a certain point in your life, you want to get out of the infantry. I wanted to write longer pieces. I wanted to be more personal in what I could do. I wanted to write magazine articles and books. I think there's an inevitable transformation that comes over a reporter. You cover daily events, and the more you do, and the more sophisticated you get, the more you are aware of the ways in which news can be managed, and the more you become obsessed with what you perceive as reality as opposed to news. News is often what the Assistant Secretary of State says. Reality is something much more complex, and it takes more time, more space, and I wanted to edge to what I think is... I mean, if you took the book that I wrote now on rowing and you did it as a newspaper story, it would be a very, I think, much less subtle, much less supple, much less interesting version of events.
Did you have a personal or emotional reason for writing that book? You were telling us earlier about your interest in a sport that's been unchanged by television and that still has mostly amateurs performing in it. But was there any more personal reason for
it? Well, I do row. I mean, and I had rowed at college, but that wasn't, I mean, I liked them. I liked their world. I liked the sense of obsessiveness, the passion. For one thing, I was also dealing with enormously articulate and intelligent athletes. I mean, here were these powerfully driven, obsessive athletes who loved what they did and cared about it more than anything in the world, and no one really pays any attention. And then comes an obsessive journalist who's as obsessive as they are. And so I think it's a very good combination for the book, because suddenly someone is really tapping into a volcano of feelings and emotions, and to deal with our athletes, that articulate is wonderful. And so I think it works very well in the book. I mean, all the emotion and the feeling is there. They articulate what they do very well. I mean, Tiff Wood refers to John Bigelow, one of his competitors, as having, I said, is he innocent? He said he has artificial innocence. And I once asked Tiff why he did. He said, well, I like being a hero. I like the fact that ordinary people can be heroes in the book. He says, I don't want to be in a leisure society. I like obstacles, even if in the case of rowing, he said, they are manufactured obstacles. What a nice phrase, manufactured obstacles. Artificial innocence.
Did you find that the motivations of the athletes in rowing were different than the motivations of, for instance, the basketball players that you toured with when you were writing your book, The Breaks of the Game?
Sure, they're obsessive. I mean, athletes, world-class athletes, dominating athletes are obsessive to start with, and they are, I think, they're driven, and they have an enormous impulse to try and sort of, in effect, write their signature on the forehead of their nearest competitors. I mean, that they have that in common. But the professional basketball player is, by and large, from the ghetto. He's black. He's poor. More often than not, his father hasn't been around in a long time. And playing basketball becomes his ticket out of the ghetto. So he spends 6 hours a day out there. He's not unlike, in fact, the Jewish violinists in small Russian towns at the turn of the century, who the only ticket out of those small towns and out of the anti-Semitism of that era in Russia was to be a great violinist. And that's what these, I mean, I think it's often, I think American sports fans look at a great black basketball player, they think he is a natural. And by the standards of many white athletes, he is a natural, but he's also been working and working and working on it because it is a passion and it is his own way, it's his only way of articulating who he is. It's his only statement. With the rowers, and that kind of, and it's very easy, I think, for the average American to identify with that kind of obsession. The obsession of the rower, of the son of the upper middle class, Tiff Wood of Beacon Hill, or John Bigelow of Bellevue, suburban Seattle, Washington. I mean, I think that's harder. I mean, I think I write in the book that the last, I mean, they're all privileged. They're all family supported. And yet, in many ways, they work as hard or harder than the professional athletes. They put in 4 or 5 hours a day. Their particular event brings the guarantee of pain. Terrible pain every time they row. And I think I write in the book that one could understand the black athlete, but probably the last real stronghold of madness in sports is rowing, the amateur there. I mean, the amateurs are the last really mad people in our sports. But it is their signature as well. It is what makes them feel better about themselves, gives them confidence, and becomes, at a moment when they are shaky in college or in prep school, becomes the thing that gives them a good feeling about themselves.
Because you've mentioned obsession so much and described yourself initially as being really obsessed.
I'm an obsessed journalist, yeah.
Yeah, are you still...
I would like to think that when I do something that no one will do it better.
Are you still as obsessed as you were since you've been at it for so long? Maybe that obsession starts to...
Well, I like to think that I'm a healthier... I think I'm a relatively normal person in the off hours, and I think I don't jump around and shout and scream when I'm working. I think I'm more clinical in my approach now. I mean, I'm older and I don't get beaten up as much anymore. But I think in terms of work, a desire for excellence, I think if you asked one of the young rowers or one of the basketball players that I dealt with, but one of the rowers, I think they would say, oh yeah, he's like us. I mean, the way I would keep going back to them. I mean, I would not only interview them 3 or 4 times for 3 or 4 hours at a time, but I kept, if something came up, I would call them back and say, look, I think in terms of professional excellence, I'm as obsessed as ever. I really still want that work to be better. I believe there's always one more anecdote, one more story, one more fact that I can get if I'll just give it a little bit more. The belief that you can make it better is still there. But the rest of my life is more normal now.
That was journalist and author David Halberstam. His new book, Amateurs, is about the sport of rowing. It's published by Knopf. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The engineer for this edition was Joyce Lieberman. Fresh Air is edited by Maeve McGoran. Amy Salad is the associate producer. Danny Miller and I co-produce the show. My name's Terry Gross, and I want to thank you for listening.
National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible with the financial support of listeners to WHYY-FM, Philadelphia. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.